Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California public health officials are holding off on declaring a statewide emergency for monkeypox for now. On Friday, Dr. Tomas Aragon of California's Director of Public Health said that while they're keeping a close eye on monkeypox and are taking it seriously, the infrastructure from COVID is in place to get necessary vaccines out to those who need them, and that the surveillance of the disease is working well. This, despite the fact that San Francisco, the day prior, declared its own citywide state of emergency. That's because the city says the state and the feds need to be more aggressive in fighting monkeypox, and there's a growing concern that it's being labeled as a disease that only the LGBTQ plus community needs to worry about, much like the AIDS epidemic back in the early 1980s. Emily Hoven joins us now from CalMatter. She has been following this. Good morning, Emily. Welcome back.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
First off, what are the latest numbers when it comes to the infections of monkeypox in our state? And what are some of the hot zones in California?
Yeah, so last time the state reported an update on monkeypox cases, there were about 786 cases that were known statewide and had been reported. And the main hotspots are in Los Angeles and San Francisco. And so you actually have seen a lot of the attention focused on those two areas. And there's now pressure mounting in Los Angeles to declare a state of emergency, given that they actually have more numeric cases than San Francisco. But San Francisco being a much smaller community, I think that leaders there are obviously taking it very, very seriously.
So nearly 800 cases, is it likely that this could be an underestimate?
I think definitely. I mean, I think it also depends on people's access to testing. And this is one of the things that state lawmakers and local leaders have been calling on the state and the federal government to ramp up. It was kind of interesting because the state public health officer mentioned on Friday in a statement that the state now has the capacity to process about 1,000 monkeypox tests a day, which when you think about it, seems like a very small number, considering that, as you said, we do have this COVID infrastructure in place, and all of these testing labs and testing sites that were sprung up over the past couple of years. But it's a reminder that, I guess, apparently these labs cannot just pivot quickly to testing and processing monkeypox tests. And so I think that in order to actually know how many people have monkeypox, you would have to have much more expansive testing than we currently do have.
Yeah, we don't have to go too far back to kind of live through the testing backlogs that we all endured just, you know, about, you know, a year or two ago. Can you define monkeypox, and why is the LGBTQ plus community especially being hard hit by this disease?
Yeah, so it is a virus that has been around for a long time, but has sort of started to just kind of spring back up again recently. And basically, it creates these lesions on your skin that can become very, very painful. And, you know, state public health officers emphasize that it's not fatal. It's harder to spread than COVID. You have to be in very close proximity to someone, you know, kissing them or cuddling with them or potentially, you know, having, you know, it being intimate with them or sharing the same sheets or towels as they would. And so it's a bit harder to spread. And I think part of the reason it has gotten so caught up with the LGBTQ community is that the state just released data for the first time showing that about 92% of cases have occurred in gay and lesbian Californians, and about 98% in men. So men who are bisexual or who are gay. And they have said that it's, you know, you're more likely to get it if you're having sexual contact with multiple partners. And so even though officers are emphasizing that it is not an STD, it is not something that you get, it's not a sexually transmitted disease. Nevertheless, these cases seem to have been most pronounced among members of these communities.
Yeah, and it may not just be isolated to that as cases continue to increase, and especially given that it's skin-to-skin contact or even sharing clothes, that could it can be infectious just by that. Why is there a shortage of the vaccine, though, Emily, if this isn't a new disease and vaccines are available?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question. That's what has frustrated so many state lawmakers. And we really have seen State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco be very aggressive in calling out the federal government for failing to have enough of these vaccines just on hand in general in case of an outbreak, and not rushing to procure more once it became clear that these cases were starting to spread more quickly. I think part of the reason why, you know, the state and the federal government had not been stockpiling these vaccines is that this disease, this virus, I think for a long time was sort of considered not a threat. Like, it had more or less been eradicated. And so, you know, it was here and there, but it wasn't ever becoming this, like, this thing that was going to concern the general population. And so I think now that it is starting to spread a lot more quickly after years and years of not doing so, it's sort of like we were caught flat-footed and we didn't have the things in place, even though, as you say, there is a vaccine. And as it stands right now, there's only one maker of the monkeypox vaccine. I believe they're based in Denmark, and you know, they're rushing to meet the demand of the entire globe, which they're having a hard time doing. So I think we're going to see a lot of other companies, you know, trying to help and add to the supply in any way that they can.
Given that the California Department of Public Health estimates that California will need, you know, upwards of 800,000 additional doses, that sounds like a lot. Is that a lot, Emily?
I guess. You would have to divide that by two because each series is about two shots. But I think it is and it's not, because that specific number they got from basically calculating the people that would be highest at risk in California, which, as we have discussed, are so far members of the LGBTQ community who have had two or more sexual partners. And so I think if you were to start expanding that beyond that to the general population, right, obviously you're going to need many, many more. And to your point that it can spread to people outside of that community, there was actually a toddler that tested positive in California about a week or so ago. I think just because they lived in a household with someone who had been exposed to it. And so, you know, if it starts becoming more and more widespread, I think that 800,000 number is definitely not going to be enough.
When it comes to the city of San Francisco, what does the state of emergency in that city help unlock in terms of resources and surveillance?
Yeah, so basically declaring that state of emergency just allows them to streamline their response, cut certain parts of the red tape of how government functions, and be able to pull down more funds to basically funnel everyone in focused on this response. And so I think, you know, part of it is the logistical aspect of it. And then I think there's also the aspect of sort of declaring it that I think is an important milestone, especially for members of the LGBTQ community who say, look, like, we don't want this to become the next AIDS. We want to know that the government is taking this really, really seriously and is investing as much resources and time as they can in addressing it and not just looking the other way while people get sick and are in a lot of pain. Even if it's not something that seems to be often fatal. And so I think that's why we are also seeing the pressure mount on the state to do this, you know, partially for those logistical streamlining and the ability to pull down more funds, but then also the ability to just kind of recognize this as a threat to a very specific group of people and then potentially more people as well as it continues to spread. And I just want to note one last thing on that that's kind of interesting is that the state, I think, obviously right now is saying, okay, look, people are not dying from this. Like, we have it somewhat under control. We don't want to declare a state of emergency. I think part of that also could be because the governor's administration has faced a lot of pushback for his COVID state of emergency, which is still in place after about 2.5 years. And a lot of his Republican critics have basically accused him of, you know, trying to keep in place his executive powers for such a long time. And I think if he were to declare another state of emergency, you might see that argument have a resurgence as well.
Yeah, and not to mention monkeypox is extremely painful, the lesions that you get on your body. Is that also why local officials or State Senator Scott Wiener and then obviously Mayor London Breed from San Francisco, they've been frustrated with the state and the federal public health response in taking on this public health crisis?
Yeah, I think definitely. And I think, you know, Scott Wiener, who is a gay man and has talked frequently about his experiences, he's kind of saying, look, like, this is another failure of particularly the federal government to recognize what people go through when they are part of the LGBTQ community and not taking the risks that they face, the health risks and these things seriously, and just kind of shunting them to the side. And I think for Mayor London Breed, obviously, you know, representing San Francisco, a city that has always been very proud of its diverse community, I think she wants to signal that she is taking this very seriously and she is recognizing what members of this community are going through. And, you know, hopefully targeting the response to those who need it most. San Francisco is actually setting aside 30% of its vaccines at one of its public health clinics to gay and bisexual Latino men, because they have found demographically that that demographic in San Francisco has had a disproportionate amount of monkeypox cases. And so really ensuring that those who are the hardest hit have the most resources available to them.
Does an emergency declaration that the city of San Francisco made free up the flow of money when it comes to vaccines and testing?
It does. And it allows them to kind of just streamline a lot of how these things get processed and coordinate the responses of different agencies. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, a lot of people want more flexibility. Recently, a group of 11 Democratic lawmakers from the state of California sent the federal government a letter basically saying, look, like, you gave us all this money for COVID testing, this federal money. Can you make it flexible enough that we can also pivot and use this for our monkeypox vaccination and testing efforts? And so I think there are these efforts to kind of free up maybe pots of COVID money that maybe aren't so necessary anymore now that things have sort of seemed to die down, and funnel that into the monkeypox threat.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Emily Hoven from CalMatters about California's response to monkeypox. You touched upon COVID numbers, and this latest round of monkeypox is coming as COVID numbers are starting to show signs of stabilization or plateauing. What can you tell us on that front?
Yeah, it's kind of a really interesting situation in terms of COVID. Obviously, we've been going through these ups and downs for years now. And after this latest surge with almost record high case positivity numbers, that number is starting to stabilize. What is really interesting, though, is that there was a recent report that found that for the first 3 weeks of July, about 1 in 7 new cases of COVID in California were actually reinfections, referring to people who had tested positive before and recovered and then caught it again, you know. And we had some very prominent scientists in California saying, look, like, we actually need to be researching the effects of people catching COVID numerous times in a row. And I think that as this pandemic continues to stretch on, and obviously more and more people will have either been vaccinated or tested positive and tested positive again, kind of understanding how those repeat infections are going to affect California and potentially inform the rest of its COVID response. Because, yeah, at this point, you know, I think that we've all kind of accepted the virus is here to stay with us for a while. And so understanding this new phase of the pandemic, I think, is going to be incumbent on state and local public health officers.
Well, finally, Emily, I mean, getting to that response, I mean, one example recently, Los Angeles County was going to reinstate a mask mandate. They have since backed off on reinstating a mask mandate. What happened there? And what does that signal just really statewide, what public health officials are grappling with?
I think it's always that balance between, you know, what they feel is their duty to protect the safety of the most vulnerable members in their community, and then also just, you know, kind of the exhaustion of constantly switching on and off these various mandates. And it's kind of confusing messaging for a lot of people to understand. And people may or may not comply. And so then they raise the question of, you know, what's the point of doing it if no one's going to listen to it? And the reason why Los Angeles County backed off from reinstating this universal indoor mask mandate was because their numbers stabilized enough that it actually dropped them out of the highest level of community transmission as defined by the CDC. And so that allowed them to kind of say, okay, well, you don't need to have this, you know, right now. But it is interesting because Los Angeles County is somewhat of an outlier. Actually, at the time that they were considering this mask mandate, 50 out of 58 counties in California were in that high transmission level in the CDC, and Los Angeles County was the only one that was potentially considering this mask mandate, and not even the Bay Area was. And so I think that it does also indicate that different public health officers in California are starting to adopt somewhat different approaches based on their own communities and their own understanding of what's necessary. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this continues to unfold over the next couple of months.
Still a lot of content for your What Matters daily newsletter. Emily, thank you for joining us with the breakdown and an update.
Thanks so much, Vicky.
Emily Hoven is with CalMatters, and we have a link to Emily's latest articles on our Insight page at capradio.org. Up next, UC Davis will share the findings of its annual report about Lake Tahoe's biggest ecological challenges and what solutions are out there. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Lake Tahoe is the sapphire crown jewel of the Sierra Nevada. The Washoe tribe are the original inhabitants of what they named Daoaga, edge of the lake. And the word Tahoe is actually a mispronunciation of the Washoe word for lake. Since then, John Muir has called the largest alpine lake in North America a water heaven. And today, roughly 40,000 people call Tahoe home, with some 15 million tourists each year. But a new report is once again raising the alarm over the lake's long-term health. The report is from the Tahoe Environmental Research Center at UC Davis, which has conducted yearly reports on the lake since 1968. That's more than 50 years. Joining us now is the center's director, Jeffrey Schlatto. Jeffrey, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicky. Nice to be here.
Given that you're the founding director of the Tahoe Environmental Research Center, how long have you been studying Lake Tahoe, and what drew you to Lake Tahoe?
Well, I actually started working there, it was 1995. I'm originally from Australia, the driest continent, and coming to Tahoe the first time, it was very alluring. It was just coming over Echo Summit, and I felt I needed to do more here.
Yeah, I remember my first time taking that trip over Echo Summit and that turn, and then you see the beautiful vastness of Lake Tahoe. What still excites you about researching Lake Tahoe, you know, decades later?
Well, it's a large lake, but when you compare it to something like Lake Superior, it's quite small. It's the feeling of when you're in the middle of the lake and looking around, you can actually see the whole perimeter of the watershed, of the whole basin, and this idea that this is really a natural laboratory to study the lake, the forests, everything. And especially, as you say, 15 million people, what impact do we have on the lake?
Yeah, and as we've learned, we do have a great deal of impact. Given that researchers at UC Davis have been continuously monitoring the lake since 1968, what has been the goal of these annual reports?
Well, part of it is just seeing what the status and trends of the lake are. Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? I think it was Charles Goldman sort of first started this in the late 50s, but late 60s was when it was became regular. The goal was originally just to bring it back to its full clarity, but that's turned out to be a very big challenge because of an evolving set of challenges.
Yeah, I mean, given that this monitoring has been happened for more than half a century, what have been the biggest changes in that time?
Well, I guess the gorilla is climate change. So we wrote our first paper on climate change at Tahoe in 2006. And you know, what we were predicting or foreseeing at that time has come true, and probably more. But it's starting to evolve now. It's not just the lakes getting warmer or the summer season is extending. It's, you know, this year for the first time we're seeing, you know, very large changes on the ecology and the biology of the lake, and that was something that did catch us by surprise. Mm.
Given that Lake Tahoe, it's the largest alpine lake, but I understand that other lakes are larger, but it's still quite large. It's 72 miles of shoreline. It's the second deepest lake in America, Crater Lake National Park being first in Oregon. That's a good amount of researching playground for you. How are you able to do such a thorough report on such a wide expanse, and what are the biggest challenges in doing so?
Well, first and foremost, we have an incredible team. And so we have people who work in the forest and on the lake, and we have scuba divers and things like that. The hardest part is continuity. A lot of our funding comes from agencies, state agencies, the federal government, increasingly from philanthropy. So keeping the money going to allow continuity. It's one thing to say we did something for 3 or 4 years, and then stopped. And that's always the biggest shame is having to stop something interesting.
Well, let's get to this year's annual report. What surprised you about it?
Well, as I said, it was the biology. So seemed to be three parts to it. One is what most people experience when they go to Tahoe and they're on the beach or clambering around the rocks. It's the attached algae on the rocks, and it's this other kind of algae, you know, we refer to it as metaphyton. It's free-floating, but in long clumps that washes up on the beach. So that's certainly one thing, or those two parts of the nearshore algae is something that has really exploded this year. And it's even since we put this report together, the metaphyton on the South Shore is just exploding.
What's contributing to the increase in this algae?
I wish we really knew definitively. You know, one of the ideas is you know, we've lost just, again, in the last year or two, some of the a lot of the zooplankton. These are the microscopic animals that eat algae and eat smaller animals. They themselves have disappeared. And if you've suddenly lost, well, you can imagine, think of it as a garden. If you've suddenly lost the gardeners, then the garden and the weeds and everything is running amok in a way. So that could be one of the things. It could be inputs from sort of the wildfire smoke from last year certainly played a part, but not the major part. The big riddle is the last 2 years, 3 years even, have been very, very dry years, drought years. And we normally get a lot of nutrients, you know, which feed the plants, mm-hmm. from the streams. Yet, despite record low flows and nutrient inputs, we're getting record high algae.
Mm. When we're talking about zooplankton, I mean, your report really zeroed in on mysis shrimp and also phytoplankton. What role, if you can expand on that, do these tiny creatures play in Lake Tahoe's overall health?
Well, they were introduced to Lake Tahoe. The mysis shrimp themselves were introduced in the mid-60s. And, you know, soon after their introduction, it was noticed that other zooplankton had disappeared. So they're larger than most zooplankton. You can think of them as being about the width of your fingernail, half the width of your fingernail. So they're very voracious in their appetites. What they particularly consumed was something called Daphnia, which is also known as the water flea, but it's an omnivorous creature. It just eats everything. It just shovels whatever it can into its mouth. And a lot of what it was shoveling were very fine silts and clays, as well as very small algae. So with its demise to mysis, we suddenly lost this internal cleaning capacity. And that was happening at the same time when development at Tahoe was taking off. So we had these two negative forces, the loss of internal cleaners plus a lot of the erosion, a lot of the disturbance created by millions of people starting to come in.
So mysis shrimp were introduced about 50 years ago, correct?
Correct.
And when you were talking about Daphnia, those water fleas, aren't those good for kokanee salmon? Is there this kind of tug and pull of these different organisms and the impact that they're having on the lake's clarity, but also other species that are home to the lake?
Yeah, well, kokanee salmon is another introduced species, so it's sort of hard to know where to stop in all of this. Unlike the mysis, kokanee salmon seem to be a welcome addition. I mean, they're beautiful fish. The kokanee salmon probably feed more on small native minnows, but the native minnows like the Daphnia. And so, yeah, we have disturbed the system. And I don't think, while it's maybe a lofty goal to say we want to restore it to what it was, we know that would never happen. But I think it can be restored to something closer to what its native system was, so that introduced species that are considered desirable, like the kokanee, a lot of people like fishing for lake trout. Again, another introduced species. And one of the long-term goals is to introduce or reintroduce the Lahontan cutthroat trout, which was the native fish.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Jeffrey Schlatto, director of the Tahoe Environmental Research Center at UC Davis, providing more details on this year's State of the Lake report at Lake Tahoe. We're talking about a lot of contributing factors here. And one of the quotes in the release that stuck out to me, I mean, you had said any one of these changes would be a big deal in a single year. All three occurring at once is particularly alarming. What does that mean?
Well, I thought it was self-explanatory. Clearly it's not. I think it's that, to me, it's suggesting that the system in this last year became very out of balance. I mean, we don't understand, at least I don't understand, why we have this, you know, the algae in the lake have increased by three times, possibly five or six times over the long-term mean, and why it occurred so quickly. One idea is, well, as I said, the zooplankton, the mysis are missing. Maybe the grazing's not going on. You know, there are people who say, well, they wouldn't eat those things normally. So there are lots of unanswered questions. So it is a matter of concern, but the point I try to make is that it's also a great opportunity. We don't, you know, when things are normal, when things are sort of in balance, even if it's a balance we don't like and not the balance we're trying to achieve, it's hard to notice changes. But suddenly we have, the system has received this huge change and it's going to respond. So what we're expecting is that now that the mysis are gone, at least temporarily, we're going to see Daphnia come back. We want to know how quickly they're growing. Are they increasing the clarity and why? Are the little minnows increasing in size and in numbers? Are the fish getting larger? So all this possibility, this little window that's open for maybe 3 or 4 years. And that's where I think there's a great opportunity. And once we know those things, then it's a whole lot easier to start designing, you know, different management approaches. Mm.
Your center also has a report, and you released it last month, on the clarity of Lake Tahoe to go in combination with this annual State of the Lake report. We were talking about how development really began about a half century ago and has had a dramatic impact on the lake. What was the clarity of the lake 50 years ago, and what is it now?
Well, back then it was something like 100 feet. So, I mean, that wasn't the same every week, every month. It fluctuated. Typically, it's clearer in winter than in summer. Right now, it's more like 70 feet. So we've lost over 30 feet of clarity. What many of us find disappointing is that it stayed at that level for about the last 20 years. You know, despite a lot of investment, a lot of science, and a lot of people trying to do what we all thought was the right thing. It's just not. It's not working as quickly or as well as we'd hoped. So, you know, one idea is, well, if the focus till now has been on reducing what comes into the lake, albeit imperfectly, maybe in combination with activities that restore this internal cleaning capacity, maybe that's what we need.
Mm. given that roughly 8 million people live within a half day's drive to Lake Tahoe, what has the human impact been on the lake in recent years or in the past 20 years, since when it comes to clarity, it's kind of just plateaued?
Well, I mean, what causes the decline in clarity is actually pretty simple. Doing something about it is the hard part. So it's because of the wavelength of light, we know that it's very small particles in the size range of about 1 to 4 microns. Bearing in mind the thickness of a hair is about 100 microns. So these are literally invisible particles, but they affect light. So keeping those out of the lake is very hard. It's a tough engineering problem, which is why we need alternative approaches. So we know what the problem is. As people come into the basin, as they tramp around the forest, as they drive on the roads, and dust gets wafted up into the air, it all floats out onto the lake and eventually settles. Wildfire smoke brings fine particles onto the lake. So that's one issue is the source of what's there. The other is where climate change comes in. So climate change is giving us more rain and less snow. We're getting the runoff into the lake occurring sooner. And when a stream comes into the lake, whether it floats out across the surface or whether it plunges down to the bottom, again, depends on the warmth of the lake and how that's changing. So there's no end to complexity. Mm-hmm. And I guess part of our mission is to try to sort through the complexity and make it as simple as we can.
When you were talking about those incredibly fine particles in the water, you know, there's been a growing conversation, and I just think general knowledge when it comes to microplastics. What role are microplastics having on Lake Tahoe?
Well, it's more than we would have thought, it seems. Unlike most places where sewage water goes back into the source water. So here we are in Sacramento, and between the source of the Sacramento River water and where we are, water is being withdrawn from the river, consumed, treated, and reinjected back into the river. So a lot of microplastics come in through our wastewater. Lake Tahoe has the great fortune and luxury of not having wastewater discharged into it. All the wastewater is from taken outside the basin. But we have microplastics sort of in a similar level to many other places. Where are they coming from? Well, it's coming from purely our activities, our littering, our maybe overuse of plastics, things like that. So it's a problem that we probably have. It's within our ability to control, but it requires changing human behavior, which is a really tough problem.
Given that wildfires also contribute to the lake's declining clarity, and, you know, we've become more accustomed to mega fires. It doesn't even have to be the Caldor Fire, which was near Tahoe. It could be the Dixie Fire or other wildfires, not even in California. I mean, what kind of projection do you have in terms of the role the wildfires in years to come are going to have on Lake Tahoe's overall health?
Well, that has been a big concern. I guess last year, a group of scientists from several institutions, we were working collectively to understand the impacts of last year's fires. I mean, they were, you know, the largest as far as smoke input that we have experienced. We're just probably a couple of months away from having a final report on that. But whatever the consequence is, it's something we're going to have to adapt to, because the fires are going to stay, as you say. They don't even have to be local. And it's, once again, one of these impacts of climate change.
Yeah, and give it further compounded by adapting or getting accustomed to drought conditions from one year to the next. Last year, the natural rim or the lake level fell below the natural rim, and which means it stopped flowing into the Truckee River. Could that happen again this year? And if so, is that normal from one year to the next, consecutive years of that happening?
Well, last year it happened for about a day, 2 days. It was just sort of just kissed the rim, and then we had rain and snow, and it came up again. This year it almost certainly will happen, probably mid-October, because this was a dry year. If it's another dry winter, then we'll be several feet below that natural rim this time next year. That's one thing. There is a lot of data on going back to the early 1900s, and it seems that the rapidity with which water level is changing is going up. A lot of water is, you know, there's a dam at Tahoe. A lot of water is shipped downstream. Planning for how much is enough and how much is not enough is a really tough problem. So it will happen. There's really 6 foot that the water managers have to play with there. So 6 foot is the top of the dam, and below that is the rim. So I think it will happen, and what we can do about it is yet one more problem a lot of people are working on.
Yeah. You held a webinar on this annual report. What kind of response have you received in, you know, in the days since this latest report was released?
Actually, it's been a really great response. It was, I guess, this idea of the biological change providing an opportunity, I think, has been well received. Very often the last few years, you know, the theme is it's climate change and what can you do about it? Well, locally, not much. But suddenly the idea that we've had change, we're starting to understand what it means, and yeah, we can tackle it and try to learn from it, I think is a very positive message, and hopefully the funding to do that will be forthcoming.
Sustainable funding.
Sustainable, thank you.
Yeah, that's the important part of it. Finally, you dedicated the report to the entire Tahoe community to recognize really their resilience following last summer's wildfires. What would you like us to take away from this conversation, and how would you like us to think of Lake Tahoe moving forward?
Well, I mean, those of us who live at Tahoe, who work at Lake Tahoe, I think we're privileged. It's like living in a national park in a way, but it also gives us this responsibility to preserve it, to try to minimize our own impact on the land and to be good stewards for others. So to the extent that we survived the fire, I had friends who, you know, were evacuated and thought they'd never come back to a house or to a job. They survived. So I think this is, for them, just reinforcement that things are pretty tenuous, but we have a chance to improve them.
Yeah, there's some encouraging solutions within what could be a pretty dire report when you unpack it. Jeffrey, thank you so much for breaking down this year's State of the Lake report.
Thank you, Vicki.
Jeffrey Schlatto is the director of the Tahoe Environmental Research Center at UC Davis, providing more details on this year's State of the Lake report at Lake Tahoe. Still ahead, we'll meet Cafe Colonial, a beloved Sacramento all-ages venue in need of a lifeline to stay open. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The arts and culture scene is still recovering from the scars of the pandemic 2+ years, causing massive disruption to the industry. A live venue in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood is among those fighting to stay open. Cafe Colonial was originally conceived as part of the Colonial Theater, built back in 1940. The current chapter of Cafe Colonial is an independent all-age sanctuary for many. But now the venue is on the verge of closing its doors permanently. Owners Gabrielle and Ben Garcia have put in everything to keep Cafe Colonial open for the Sacramento music community. Gabrielle joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
In 2018, the former owner announced that the closure of Cafe Colonial, the doors closed, but quickly Cafe Colonial experienced that shot of adrenaline. You became owners along with Ben Garcia. Take us back to that moment. What attracted you to Cafe Colonial?
We were the current owners of the Blue Lamp on Alhambra Boulevard, which was a 21 and over music venue only. And when we saw the Cafe Colonial struggling, we thought it would be best for the community and the live music scene to kind of save an all ages venue. It starts, you know, at the young years, people bring their children, they come as teenagers, young adults, and then as old guys.
I would imagine, were there some parallels that existed with your work running Blue Lamp and Cafe Colonial?
Absolutely. Our staff came over with us. We ran both of them for about a year. And then ultimately, due to landlord decisions, vacated Blue Lamp in January of 2020, put our full focus into Cafe Colonial. And it was really starting to take off in March of 2020.
Can you explain the footprint that Cafe Colonial has to the music community in Sacramento?
I don't even think I realized how important it was until pandemic hit and being almost completely crowdfunded. And when we're in trouble, crowdfunding, it's so motivating to know that the community really supports it when it's in need. So it's extremely warms my heart to know that, you know, and gives us the energy to keep going when we know that the community really needs it and wants it.
Going back to when you took over the venue in 2019 and it opened, I mean, it was a short time the following year. Obviously, the pandemic hit and we know what happened. Can you just explain to us navigating such an unprecedented time and the obstacles that you had to endure?
I now know why grant writing is a college degree. I probably wrote maybe 300 or 400 grants with no prior knowledge or experience in that field. It gives hope. It was just a huge roller coaster of emotions of, you know, availability of funding and then getting funding, not getting funding, asking the community for help, having teenagers throw live stream events and DJs in the community and promoters in the community doing all of this thing via the internet to make sure that when it was safe to do so. We also took very, very strong precautions and waiting to open and not opening and closing and opening and closing during the pandemic. We just kind of hibernated for as long as we possibly could to just try to save what we had.
Despite there being a pandemic, you know, life doesn't stop and the challenges of life doesn't stop. What are your main obstacles now?
Well, we had some issues with the building. It's an old building and then being closed for such an extended period of time. Our pipes had collapsed when we came back and tried to reopen and just kind of going through all the struggles of reopening, not only with new protocols and expenses, but as well as just, you know, functioning of maintenance of machines that haven't ran in a couple of years. So it's definitely been a struggle. It continues to be a struggle. And, you know, we have very successful nights and very successful events, and it's hard to kind of understand how we could be struggling and being successful at the same time. But in today's climate and the, you know, we still have shows canceling. COVID is still very much a real thing. We still do not want to expose people to COVID. Bands are still canceling because they're catching COVID on tour and things of that nature, as well as the local community. We had a a festival Saturday, and the main act who put it together unfortunately couldn't play due to COVID. So it still affects us in a day-to-day and still trying to make the best decisions for the community as possible while still being open and providing a safe environment in all aspects. I think that the most important thing about the Cafe Colonial is that it's a safe space for people of all ages. Mm.
What is your concern level that Cafe Colonial might not be able to stay open in the long term?
I feel like even if it's not me and Ben, that it will continue to thrive. It is something that the community will step up and take care of, you know, whether it's under our direction or someone else's direction. It's the one thing that we would never step away without knowing that it would continue to go on.
It's big. It's bigger than you.
It is bigger than us. And it was very much, you know, we were working at Harlow's as bartenders and staff and owning the Cafe Colonial when the pandemic hit. So in a matter of days, we lost our jobs and our business, boarded up our windows, filed for unemployment. My husband was denied, you know, and within the year, we ended up getting full-time jobs and kind of coming to the conclusion that we might be more philanthropists than business owners. And in order to fund it, it might take some little extra work somewhere else.
Given that there's a GoFundMe account that has been set up to help keep the doors open under your ownership, I mean, it's raised, I believe, over $20,000 and even an additional $5,000 from private donors. What does that say to you? What does that mean to you?
It means that it's extremely important to the community. And of that $20,000, we're talking $5 from teenagers. They're Wow. spending their lunch money to keep this open. I always say, like, Cafe Colonial and the safe space that it is and what it allows the children to do, it is real life suicide prevention. This is where the kids gather. This is where they communicate. This is where they create. This is where they release their art, their music, their, you know, learning the sound production of how a stage runs, a show works, how to do booking, all of these things that really help promote culture and music in Sacramento.
It truly can be a sanctuary. You mentioned that you worked at Harlow's. Given that Harlow's, which is also a music venue, is stepping in to advocate for Cafe Colonial, I think that just says so much about Sacramento's arts and culture and music community. Can you explain what that means and how y'all are kind of bound together in really a wonderful way?
Sometimes it's really, really hard to be the little guy and people don't really take notice. So it's so important that you know, Jim at Harlow's and Julia have been extremely supportive in this process and also understand how important it is that the more successful we all are, the more successful we all will be. Hmm. And really taking us as like a little brother, sister kind of venue and, you know, and here to help and advocate for us. They have better contacts. They have a bigger voice. And it really showed the community how important we are to everyone at all levels.
Have you had any response from the city of Sacramento or the Chamber of Commerce?
I have not heard from Megan Voorhees yet. I did see on the internet that she did mention it was on her radar, but we have had very little support from, you know, the city as far as that's concerned. We did get an artist grant, I think, back in late 2020 when they did some of the funding for the community and for the artists. So. But outside of that, and right now with the Stockton redevelopment program and how actually clean and active we keep the block, you know, it might be a little bit important for the city to kind of recognize and not let something like this go to the wayside.
Explain the neighborhood that surrounds Cafe Colonial.
It's a historic neighborhood in Sacramento. It's Oak Park. It has been socially economically challenged for many years. It's currently receiving an influx, some may call gentrification, but they're building probably close to over 300 units within a block of the Cafe Colonial, some directly across the street and some directly next door. And on any given night, we're typically the only business open on the block. So it brings life and, you know, lights and energy to the block that may otherwise be dark.
finally, Gabrielle, what other performances do you have lined up so far this summer?
We have shows, I would say, 4 to 5 nights a week. We have some everything for everyone, everything from punk rock to indie music to metal. Check out the calendar, cafecolonial916.com. We have tickets available there and a calendar up. We do Taco Tuesdays every Tuesday. Come get some tacos. They're delicious. We appreciate everyone's support more than we could ever say.
Well, Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us. And I wish Cafe Colonial the best.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I appreciate you.
That is Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcasts on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.